said earlier, which leads into a whole bunch of different wars, a whole bunch of disunity. And at the same time, you have the discovery of the New World, right? So at the same period, you also have people going across the Atlantic, not for the first time, but for the first time that sticks, for lack of a better way of saying it, with in the context of Europeans. And now this is a very confusing, but also very exciting time, right? The kind of the old, for lack of a way of saying it, the old gods or God is kind of dead in a way. There's this whole new world. And there's also becomes, there also from that grows this new kind of humanism, this new focus on like understanding the individual freedom, people's, you know, a power of action, relationships, you know, all this kind of stuff, how one views oneself in relationship to their state, how the state views itself in relationship to its subjects, all these sorts of things basically become where previously they had been relatively solidified and codified, they now all come up for debate, right? And you see this a lot in Montaigne. And, you know, to talk a little bit more, I know we kind of said earlier, he's sort of more or less regurgitating ancient philosophy, which I think is largely the case. But he's very focused on ancient skepticism with people like, you know, we think about people like Sextus Empiricus and stuff like that. And he's very interested in Stoicism and Epicureanism and stuff as well. These ancient schools that are all very humanistic. They're very focused on how to, you know, on the individual and how the individual lives, not so much in terms of like a narcissistic or egocentric kind of way, but, you know, how one can live a good life in the light of reason, not within the light of religion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the early modern move of sort of, I guess the metaphor that we can use is that the Archimedean point, I think this is the term that Arendt would use, the Archimedean point moves inward, right? I mean, in philosophy, we tend to think that this is because of Cartesianism, right? The Cartesian subject emerges, a pure sort of geometric point within subjectivity emerges, whereas before we were just one being in the great ladder of being. Now everything is relative, or all objective things are relative to an absolute subject, Cartesian subject. I think that there's a lot more that's going on there, really, as I read beyond philosophy. I mean, Arendt talks about how the invention of the telescope essentially does this, because we're no longer simply beings on this planet. We actually, well, for Arendt, it's that the human condition changes because now we can view things that we couldn't before. So our capacity for what our form of life looks like essentially changes. I think the opening up of the new world is one of those changes in the human condition, because now there's like more land, there's more things to see, people to talk about, things to take too. But there's a lot of historical changes that are happening to cause this move towards reason. People are encountering all of these new, strange, kind of essentially, like, it's appropriate to say world-changing phenomena. These world-changing events are happening, and the place that people put their stability in is within themselves, at least in Europe. They put it in reason. The light of reason becomes the Archimedean point of the early modern period.
Yeah, this is also the period of, you know, of the scientific revolution as well, as you said, with the telescope and Galileo and people like that, right? And Nicholas Copernicus, where, you know, study and justification for knowledge becomes, you know, becomes fundamental, right? No longer can one look to and just basically point towards the Bible or the church as, you know, justifications. That's not good enough anymore for, you know, the vast majority of thinking persons. you have to come up with good reasons. Now, Montaigne is focused more on effectively ethics. Like he's effectively an ethicist. The essays contain very little on things like metaphysics and stuff like that. I've actually heard, in my own study for this episode, I heard another scholar say that, you know, they actually, if someone says to them, hey, I want to get into philosophy, many of them, I often will recommend Montaigne as the first starting point because he's quite accessible. He's quite, for our listeners, if you ever pick up the books, he's quite easy to read. And he reviews a lot of like kind of classical philosophical topics, but they're primarily ethically based, how to live a good life, how to live a life of tranquility, how to deal with things like death. Or, you know, I wanted to talk about the very first essay of the work, which is titled, at least in my translation, "We Reach the Same Ends by Discrepant Means." And really, it's an essay on how human beings are extremely varied, right? Like it's an essay on contingency, on human contingency, effectively. And basically how, you know, people can and will often surprise you. They can become unexpected, and also how many people can come to the same situation through all sorts of different motivations or means or situations, right? Like basically saying that like human beings are kind of chaotic, and to try and apply, and this comes back to, you know, probably more than anything, Montaigne is an ancient skeptic, if you had to nail that him down to like one school, basically saying like, look, you can never really point to human beings in general and say, oh, human beings will do this, or they will do that, or their motivations or this, or their motivations or that, or even, you know, even inferring things about a person, right? Because so-and-so has done X, Y, Z so many times over that like the next time they're in that situation, they're going to do it again. Probably. But as Montaigne will say, like, but you don't actually know that for sure. And that comes down to probably one of his most famous quotes from his own work, which is quite simply just, what do I know? Right? Him constant. And this is a theme that comes throughout all the essays, of him constantly being like, you know, here's a good, reasonable argument for this. It would seem that things are going this direction, but they could be otherwise. Right. And I fully recognize that they could be otherwise. And I might believe such and such to be the case, but there's equally good reasons for that not to be that way. Or with just a tweak here or there, things can easily change. And so it's this sort of skeptical attitude to himself, to society, to relationships, all this kind of stuff that is very influential later on. You mentioned Descartes, who was also another person who was quite influenced by Montaigne, Descartes was also French and was born just a few years after Montaigne's death. And we know he read the essays and stuff like that. And so we know that he was influenced by this skeptical mindset. And obviously, whereas Montaigne is more of a, you know, of like the greatest student, Descartes is an example of taking this skeptical mindset and then actually turning it into his own novel theory and adding to the philosophical canon, that kind of way.
That's so interesting. I really like that you brought up this. Thematically, I guess it makes a lot of sense that this would sort of start de Montaigne's essays, this idea of contemplating contingency. And the sort of style that you bring up, where de Montaigne is, by virtue of his subject, not really coming down on like a definite theory, like a moral psychology or something like that. He wants to leave the door open for human contingency and whatnot. You're actually reminding me, there's a book I'm reading right now, E.H. Carr's What is History? And he's talking about the character of the historian. And he contrasts the historian to the philosophers and the poets, who are quite liable to use words like inevitable. The historian is very much interested in leaving things open. They understand that their interpretations are interpretations, and that interpretations of the same facts can vary between historians. I get the feeling that that's actually like, specifically, I bring this up because this is something that philosophers do not do. Like when philosophers lay down a system, that's like it exhausts the possibilities of the facts that they elaborate, right? I think that's what, because this is one of the things that we were talking about a little bit before the show, was we introduced De Montaigne as a philosopher, and he, no doubt, he is discussing philosophy and perhaps even doing philosophy, but he doesn't read like a philosopher in this sense of using words like inevitable, right? He is very liable to leave things open. He puts facts on the table, but says, you know, this is what I conclude from this. I have no problem if someone else was to even elaborate like the same ideas, but come up with something different. And in a way, that is very core to the way that an essay works. I wonder if that is also core, given that like there's this dialogical character that is going on within an essay that's always engaged with not just the subject, but the person that it's addressing with that subject. It has to leave something open for response. Whereas like when Descartes writes the Meditations, he's opening them up for objections and whatnot. Like, if I remember correctly, the Meditations are actually like the first work of peer-reviewed literature, considering that he opened them up for objections and replies. But they're not the same kind of objections and replies that De Montaigne would have gotten, right? It's not necessarily like a back and forth that someone could have said like, well, I would have thought of this differently, or you extrapolate on some conclusion that De Montaigne draws from. With Descartes, it's like, okay, you know, you're wrong in premise two of your argument or something like that. Here's another way of putting it is like, what would refuting De Montaigne look like, right? Like philosophers get refuted, but an essayist, it just inspires more essays, you know?
Well, it's hard to refute a skeptic, I think, in many cases. But an interesting thing, even for Montaigne within that, is, again, coming back to the form of the essay, and especially how Montaigne used it, is interestingly, if the work that I have, which is the Penguin Classics edition, when you read through the essay, you'll notice in brackets throughout the works, the letters in capitalized A, B, C throughout. These actually are points of edits that Montaigne made to his own work. So he wrote the essays, but then he spent years rereading them and revising and responding. And apparently he very, very rarely took anything out, but he continually added new points or responses or counter responses within his own work. So in a way, they were kind of like living texts, and there's like three main periods of like response, this like the ABC format that the translator uses for my works. But I think that that's, you know, comes back around to, the notion of the what Montaigne's doing of the essay is being a more of an explorative work on a particular subject rather than like a be all end all treatise, you know, slam the Meditations down on the table. You know, I figured it out. Like, what do you guys think? And more of a, meditative process on a particular subject. And he can go all sorts of different places with that. Probably one of the best examples is, for this episode, we read On the Cannibals, which ostensibly is about the New World and indigenous peoples in the New World, and a particular tribe in probably modern day Brazil or somewhere in South America that, practice cannibalism, which certainly wasn't unheard of in that area at the time. And that's ostensibly what he's writing about. But really what the essay becomes is a reflection back on his own society's opinions of those people and, frankly, his own opinions of his own society, right? You know, there was a lot of works. It was very in popular writing at the time. It was very popular to write about the New World, indigenous cultures, much of which admittedly was full of falsifications, inaccuracies, whatever it might be. But these sorts of works were extremely popular at the time, obviously. And, you know, he's sort of writing from more of a perspective of, you know, like, we think we're so, you know, that we're extremely advanced and that we are, you know, so modern and all this sorts of stuff. But, and these individuals are savages or whatever. But ultimately, like, you know, we can turn the lens back around on ourselves and see how our own practices seem extremely strange to these individuals, and that we have little, like, merit to say, you know, as someone, as Montaigne would write about, as someone who fought in French wars of religion, he was more than familiar with, you know, atrocities in wartime. So to see how, you know, he talks about how, at least from the knowledge that he had or the works that he had, that these, you know, these tribes would have these sort of ritualistic battles where the losers would, you know, be eaten by their foes or whatever. And they, everyone involved would generally show great courage. And it was sort of this, you know, consuming your enemy type thing, but it tended to be very focused on this. Whereas, you know, Montaigne would say, like, you know, we might think that that's very barbaric, but then again, like, you know, we're rolling into towns and, like, massacring everybody who isn't, like, pro-Pope. So, you know, like, are we really so different? And then, you know, I wanted to read, this is a really great little piece that he has on the cannibals, where he talks about specifically responding to Plato. And he's talking about the nature of the culture and social institutions and societal structures of these indigenous people as he understands them. And he's saying to Plato, thinking about Plato's Republic, I would tell Plato that those people have no trade of any kind, no acquaintance with writing, no knowledge of numbers, no terms for governor or political superior, no practice of subordination or of riches or poverty, no contracts, no inheritances, no divided estates, no occupation but leisure, no concern for kinship except in as is common to them all, no clothing, no agriculture, no metals, no use of wine or corn. Among them you hear no words of treachery, no lying, no cheating, avarice, envy, backbiting, or forgiveness. How remote from such perfection would Plato find that republic which he thought up? These are truly men fresh from the gods. And then he has a quote after from Virgil saying, these are the ways which nature first ordained. So basically saying, you know, look, here's Plato's Republic. Plato's Republic is, you know, is still at this time, you know, kind of the paradigm work of, like, how do we get to the ultimate Western society, right? Like, how do we build that? What are its features? What are its values, et cetera, et cetera? Well, here is a society that ostensibly has none of those features, and yet the individuals have all of these great virtues and values. And they live in a state that's almost like some sort of, like, Garden of Eden type situation. So in that sense, he's being extremely self-reflective of his own society and being very critical of his own culture. The fact of basically saying that, you know, these individuals, even though they might seemingly be, you know, simplistic or barbaric or without technology or whatever, somehow yet they've achieved all the things that we've been trying to achieve for 2,500 years, right, within the context of our own societies.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the cannibals is interesting, considering that after De Montaigne and with the rise of, you know, Rousseau and the Romantic movement in general, there is kind of this tendency to idealize or romanticize the indigenous peoples as kind of these idyllic people who are liable to leisure and whatnot. Rousseau specifically coming up with this idea of, like, the noble savage, and for all of its problems, what I like about De Montaigne is that he doesn't fall into the trap of doing that, because he's so busy being preoccupied with holding up indigenous peoples as a mirror to his own society. It's not so much about them as it is about knocking down a sort of double standard, a kind of hypocrisy that he sees. He sees that, sure, yes, okay, like, cannibalism might be barbaric, but, and the but is that, well, we certainly do barbaric things, right? It's never coming to a specific point of saying, like, here's what's good, here's what's bad. It's purely critical and skeptical in that way. And it's a very productive skepticism, right? And the other interesting thing, too, is that as we've been talking about, this is coming from the sort of early modern Enlightenment period, right? And it's inspired specifically, and he cites as his sort of criterion reason, right? He says that we have to sort of abandon the customs and the opinions because those just lead us to saying that they're barbarous, whereas we're not. But if you actually look at it from the perspective of reason, from the voice of reason, you will see that, well, even if what they do is barbarous, we can't pretend like what we do isn't, right? That's that productive criticism, the productive knocking down of a double standard that, again, and it doesn't come to, you, just like we were talking about before, it doesn't really come to like a philosophical conclusion. It's, again, like a productive negativity. If you were listening to our show on Nietzsche previously, you sort of arrive at a dissonance, right? It doesn't come to some soft conclusion like some other thinkers might draw from these events. It just brings you to somewhere to want to say more after the fact, as it were, right?
It's interesting that you bring up Nietzsche, because another, you know, Montaigne was also quite, from my understanding, quite influential on Nietzsche as well, and someone that he enjoyed reading, probably for the exact reasons that you're pointing out. You know, and another essay that we looked at for this episode was, To Philosophize is Learning How to Die, which is, Montaigne writes a lot about death and mortality. That's a thing that he preoccupied his concern quite a bit. But just as you're saying, you know, it's certainly not a work on, you know, the afterlife or any sort of certainty or anything like that.
It's not a consolation at all either.
It's certainly a work that's reads very stoically and pulls a lot from, you know, works from Seneca and stuff like that, you know, on the shortness of life and such, and a lot of other particularly Stoic philosophers who are very concerned with the questions of death. But it's a work that is really more about kind of massaging one's attitudes and personalities to be in a disposition where they can sort of to use an almost existential term, like live towards death, recognize death. And there's actually a great, before we come to an end, there's a great quote which almost prefigures some later existential work. Near the end of the essay, To Philosophize is to Learn How to Die, there's this part where he's in a conversation with nature, not with God. And it's interesting to note that even though Montaigne grew up, was essentially Catholic, it seems that he, at least once he started writing the essays, actually subscribed to some sort of view of death as annihilation, which is much more common from ancient thinkers, and seems to somewhat abandon his religiosity. But he has there's this great little line in here. Truly imagine how much less bearable for man and how much more painful would be a life which lasted forever rather than the life which I have given you. If you did not have death, you would curse me forever for depriving you of it. This to me really reminded me of a lot of much later existential thinkers who, you know, instead of, you know, giving you some sort of consolation around death, you know, it's much more about, look, death is a reality. It's a reality for us all. We're all inclusive of this. At one point he says, you know, it's the ultimate equality, that we all die. But that also death is a structuring feature of life, right? It makes the things about life which are interesting, valuable, that are just like real, that are fundamental, it makes them what they are. And that if you were to take that away, you would be, you might like it initially being immortal, but who and what you are would completely change, and it would be some kind of curse to live forever like that. And so again, you're coming to that kind of like, rather than some giving some great definitive answer or exploration, it's more about exploring the topic with reason as much as possible, but never going beyond that to make pronouncements that can't be justified in some kind of way, right? And ultimately that comes back to the sort of humanistic, anthropocentric view that Montaigne is really putting out there, that's really in opposition to the, you know, religious ordained view that had prefigured Europe up until that point. If you're interested in philosophy, if you want to dive into some stuff, Montaigne is really a great place to start. I've really thoroughly enjoyed reading a bunch of his essays. Some of them are a little bit longer. Some are very, very short. But they're really a great example of someone maybe not coming up with their own original ideas, because he didn't ever really claim to do that, but nevertheless being a very original thinker in his time and synthesizing and reviewing old ideas in a kind of a new way, at least, you know, for his period, and making them applicable to his own life and ultimately to any of his readers' lives as well. I really can't recommend them enough. If you're interested in looking into some very accessible modern, you know, early modern ethics. And he's also just an interesting guy, and he was quite a good writer as well. So anyways, this has been the Canadian Philosophy Show, and this has been our episode on Montaigne, and we hope you enjoyed, and we hope you tune in next week.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. Burnaby. Bum, 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 bum.
This is Bird Note. Birder and author Christian Cooper says listening to birds helped him unlock a kind of superpower.
It's very exciting because it's like you have a sixth sense that most people don't have. You know, I'm walking through a park on my way to the gym. I am not looking or paying attention to birds, except I am, because I always am. And my ears are telling me, oh, the white-throated sparrows are back, just from hearing their call notes.
Christian says sound mnemonics are a great way to learn bird calls. Some birds have well-known mnemonics, like the, oh, sweet Canada, 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 of the white-throated sparrow. But you can also make up your own.
One of the things I really love doing is making the connections, like I call the blue jay the Rihanna bird, because Rihanna has a song, Shut Up and Drive, where one of the parts of the song is where she goes, so if you want me, let me know, no, no. And I hear that, and I'm like, well, that's the same thing a blue jay does with its call. It's not just a flat sound, it drops at the end. So it's going, yang, yang, yang.
Looking for more tips on birding by ear? Start at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonies Franklin.
Atención.
Castéreo. Domingos 6 a 8 p.m. 90.1 CJSF Radio.
CJSF.
Pachango.
90.1 FM. Yuka Stereo. Yuka Stereo.
Atención.